Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. A true story from right here in our neighborhood has been turned into a new film called Radium Girls. The Radium Girls were a group of young women in the 1920s who changed the history of labor by exposing a severe public health crisis in the commercial use of radium. Back then, radium was a popular ingredient in all kinds of products, cosmetics, toothpaste, even food, because of a belief that it gave a person extra energy. Radium dissolved in water was even sold as a tonic. A lot of watches were made with a paint that had radium because of its natural glow. And one of the first watchmaking factories was in Orange, New Jersey, where the women employees were instructed to lick their radium-covered paintbrushes to create a finer tip. The movie Radium Girls tells a dramatized story of a group of those New Jersey factory workers who noticed and realized that their illnesses weren't accidental. Here's a clip from the trailer.
I don't know what's wrong with her.
I'm dizzy. My joints ache. I lost a tooth and two others are loose. Do you know what's wrong with me?
Absolutely nothing. You're healthy as a horse.
Where do you work?
American Radium.
We're dial painters. We believe that exposure to radium can cause devastating tissue damage.
Radium is good for you. Everyone knows that.
What does this mean for us?
We take American Radium down.
There's a doctor that can test if your bones are radioactive.
Jesse, you sound crazy. I'm not losing my job over this.
I'm scared.
I'm not going back in there.
I'm looking for Bessie and Josephine Lavallo.
They did a study. Here's her.
They own it.
Own research.
That's absurd.
It's like owning gravity.
American Radium is denying the harmful effects of radium.
All they have to do is run out the clock.
They could drag this out for years.
You don't have ears.
You'll never win.
I'm doing it, no matter what.
Radium Girls is co-directed by Oscar-nominated producer Lydia Dean Pilcher. Hi, Lydia.
Hello.
And by Ginny Moeller, who also co-wrote the screenplay. Hi, Ginny.
Hi.
It premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival in 2018 and will be playing at the Quad Cinema April 3rd through 9th, followed by a national rollout. When did you two first hear about this story of the Radium Girls?
So I was working at a small documentary company in 2012, and I was researching a project about the Manhattan Project and the atomic bomb. And I stumbled across this sentence that said, "We all remembered the tragic dial painters from World War One," and it was in the section talking about the health precautions that they took during the Manhattan Project. And I said, "I don't remember the tragic dial painters. What is that?" And I Googled it and found the Wikipedia page called Radium Girls. Sent an email to my coworkers, my friend Brittany Shaw, who wrote the screenplay with me, and I said, I think this should be a movie. So that was almost 8 years ago this month.
Wow. So Lydia, what about this story? You as an experienced producer knew that this was a good subject for a film.
Yeah, I've been an environmental activist for a long time in my personal life, and as a producer, I really wanted to find an environmental justice story to blend my passions with my career. And when I read Brittany and Ginny's screenplay, I was really moved by the idea that these were teenage girls at the center of the story, and that you could really have such a clear character arc from the beginning of this kind of age of innocence, the girls with dreams, dreams very far from Orange, New Jersey, where they were working in this factory. And the idea that there was a political awakening, an idea that the scandal was, you know, they took the steps to uncover the corporate cover-up of what had happened, and then they had to take the risk to stand up to the corporation. It was such an amazing story of female empowerment, and at the same time, it was set in a time in history that was just, 5 years after the early women's political movement mm-hmm. that emerged. Women had just gotten the right to vote. They wanted to use it. We had the League of Women Voters, the Consumers League, Jane Addams, and Hull House. These were all women that heard the Radium Girls story and brought it to the national level. So it was an amazing amalgam of women unearthing their own hidden figures, their own stories, mm-hmm. and supporting each other to raise their voices.
Jenny, you mentioned you were working in the documentary sphere. Why didn't you make a documentary? Why'd you decide you wanted to go and write a screenplay?
That is a great question. Well, first of all, there's an excellent documentary about it. It's called Radium City. That was made in the 80s. That was like a great starting point for research. But when Brittany and I started talking about what the movie version, what, you know, what the fictional version of this is, we thought about the textures, the cinema of the 1920s. Mm-hmm. And we said, what would it really feel like to be teenage girls and have these hopes and dreams? You know, our main character wants to be a movie star. The other character wants to be an archaeologist and go to Egypt. And then suddenly have your world flipped upside down by the fact that the substance that you're working with that they told you was safe, mm-hmm. is poisoning you and have 2 years to live. And so we really wanted to explore that teenage dream world and really get in like the hearts and the lives of the characters in a way that an adaptation seemed right for.
So in a way the documentary couldn't necessarily get into the emotions and the feeling of what these young women would be feeling like during this time.
Right. We really wanted to tell it from their perspective. But that said, there's actually archival footage that weaves throughout, mm-hmm. the film to set the place and the time and the fact that this is a real story and it's happening alongside all of these, yeah. other current events.
That was my next question, is that the look and the feel of the film, given there's this archival footage and at least one cartoon, which was an actual cartoon from the period of a skeleton serving tea to a young woman painting the dials. What were the conversations like about how you wanted the film to look and feel?
Well, I think we're an independent film, and we were funded by the Sloan Foundation. We had a lot of Broadway female theater producers who were very excited about the show, and so, mm-hmm. we really funded it independently. And our challenge was to how to create a scope for the story, because it was a big story. I mean, this was happening in a real world when, mm-hmm. you know, these girls were in New Jersey, but across the river there's Manhattan and there's the Stock Exchange and Sacco and Vanzetti and characters who may have just come to the East Coast from the Tulsa race riots. And these were elements and pieces of the story that we felt like gave the audience the ability to understand the context of the world. And so the easiest way to do it was to really, you know, bring in selectively a use of archival, and we created a character who's played by Susan Hayward. Her name is Etta, who lived through the Tulsa race riots and moved to the East Coast, mm-hmm. And worked in a political context, and she's a camera woman. And so through Etta's lens, we experience a lot of the footage that you might imagine she is filming. Some of our characters are also captured in black and white footage, so it kind of blends seamlessly. But for us, it was really an important part of really conveying the world.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing, that character Etta is African American.
Yes.
And there's another political element you bring into the story. Would you share that with our listeners?
Sure. So one of the things that when Brittany and I were writing the screenplay, you know, I mentioned that I was working at a documentary company. In addition to the doc that we were doing about the Manhattan Project, we were also making a 2-hour special for the History Channel about civil rights. And so as we were writing this screenplay at night and every weekend for many years, we were also surrounded by this greater historical context. And we said that, you know, and especially looking at what was happening in the 20s politically, there's a lot of anti-immigration. There's the Sacco and Vanzetti, which was sort of like a big touch point for the wider picture of what was happening. And we said, the story of the Radium Girls, and for me as someone who loves history, it's like none of it's happening in a bubble. It's mm-hmm. all interconnected. And to just tell this story of the political awakening of the Radium Girls and our main character, Bessie, would leave out really the scope of what's happening and what's impacting her. And so it was really important for us to include a storyline about the Tulsa race riot, which, you know, is its own story, its mm-hmm. own movie, it should be. And but to make sure that that was part of this world, because in reality it was part of the world and the time that they were living in.
My guests are Lydia Dean Pilcher and Jeannie Moeller. We're talking about their new film, Radium Girls. When you were thinking about casting, what were you looking for? Because the two young actresses are really they look like they're from the time. I mean, I know that's hair and makeup and all, but there's just something really sort of luminous about their faces.
Well, I think one of the things that's interesting about the story is that some of the characters in the film are based on the real characters and others are a composite. So with the Radium Girls, Ginny and Brittany really took in all the stories, and all of the details that are communicated are true and have happened, but they may have been, you know, amongst different characters. One of the Radium Girls in New Jersey, Catherine Schaub, had written a lot of diaries while she was sick, and she was considered to be very lively, with big imagination, irrepressible energy, and all of those things kind of contributed to the development of Bessie's character. And Joey King seemed to be the perfect person to kind of embody all of those qualities. And so when she read the script and she really connected to it, we were thrilled for Joey to come and play the part. Abby Quinn is an actress I had worked before on another film, and she's someone who has just a major career emerging from different films. You know, she was recently in Little Women. She was in Landline. She has that kind of presence and authentic focus, and it made the sisters and the counterpoint between mm-hmm. the sisters really dynamic.
Yeah, and I would just say, too, that the chemistry between them was so crucial. I mean, it's a story about sisters, and what would you do for your sister? What would you give up? What would, you know, especially when it comes to the courtroom fight and
for our listeners, one sister is started to exhibit some of she has the poisoning, the radium yeah. poisoning, and the younger sister is going to fight the cause for her.
Exactly. And then, you know, I won't give anything away, but there comes a point where you have to make a choice between taking care of your sister and fighting the fight. And what do you do then when the fight is for your sister?
But you also get the sense of them being teenagers and making decisions through that teenage lens, one without necessarily experience or just out of pure passion and fire. And I thought that was a really interesting part of the screenplay. I didn't know if that was something that you really wanted to highlight.
It was actually one of our earliest, both like tonal and visual inspirations for Brittany and I, was Virgin Suicides. And just thinking about, how do you capture this dreamland of being a teenager, and then for our film, so that you can turn it upside down and disrupt it. And when you disrupt it, that teenage self doesn't go away. You know, they're still, but you know, dramatically, the fact of how do you navigate this situation as a 17-year-old really is what mm-hmm. for us, you know, it's the core of the story. And how do you change? It's such a time of intense growth and change. And how does this, you know, redirect that coming of age?
I'm curious about the, you know, some of the facts in the film. I didn't realize how much radium was in like cosmetics and food, and people were selling it as a health tonic. Where did these ideas come from? Was they just something that was just sold? Was it just the snake oil situation?
I think that's a really important question, especially when we're talking about new products today. I think people wanted a miracle cure. Mm-hmm. It was marketed as a miracle cure. In some cases,
it was reducing tumors
yeah.
in medical situations. So the uses that we use it for today had already emerged as well. It was
interesting.
Yeah. And people, I think, extrapolated from that into it being a miracle elixir, a wonder drug, without, you know, knowing everything there was to know.
And it's also so helpful to think about the context in which radioactivity is new in general, and people didn't understand. This was a time when you could go into a shoe store and x-ray your foot in a shoe just for fun. So there was really, and there wasn't a lot of public understanding or long-term studies yet about radiation. And then there was also the fact that you're looking at the nascent advertising industry and this industry that is learning how to sell things that are exciting to people. And one of the things was radium.
And the company was making so much money that even when their own research studies were showing what was really going on, the money was so compelling that it you know, motivated them to cover up the truth.
We'll talk about that. My guests are Lydia Dean Pilcher and Ginny Moeller. We're talking about their new film, Radium Girls, which opens the first week of April. So in part of this cover-up, some of these women, these young women who go to a doctor, a quote-unquote doctor, and he tells them they have syphilis. Is that something you found from your research? Or was that a choice you made?
It is. We dramatized it in terms of who is diagnosed with syphilis and how, but some of the earliest death certificates of radium dial painters show that syphilis was listed as either the cause of death or related to the death. And again, it was a tactic of really slut shaming in the 1920s of, you know, this is not something you're going to challenge openly necessarily.
That was my next question, is that's a very specific choice of telling somebody what they have, you know, erroneously telling them something that they have.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, it's helpful. I think, you know, there's a lot of tactics that are still used in, you know, various industrial toxicology situations, and especially for women, anything related to, you know, being able to slut shame somebody is a powerful tactic.
In the film, I don't want to give too much away, although I think people in this area might know the story because it's just right over the river. What impact did these young women have on labor laws? We'll make it broad.
Well, I think, as Ginny pointed out, I think with the Manhattan Project, it's documented that the people leading that project really did not want what happened to the Radium Girls to happen to all the people working in that project. Mm-hmm. So it did implement a whole new wave of worker safety. Even in the follow-up of it, like the League of Women Voters in New Jersey were sponsoring legislation for workers' rights. And this was something that was new in the industrialization of America, that this idea of child labor laws or toxic regulations, this was all new. I think that, they closed the factory. The ore waste was dumped there. It was actually used in other products for making concrete and landfill. And so in Orange, in Montclair, in Glen Ridge, the contamination is vast. And it really didn't come to the attention of the residents until the 1980s. And the EPA created a Superfund priority designation for those places. And the contamination is still being worked on today.
When you think about this, Ginny, this story, what feels modern about it to you?
Everything. Everything feels modern. I mean, one of the things I think is that I'm so excited to talk about with this story is the fact that, in retrospect, it's very obvious that licking radioactive paint is a terrible idea, is a deadly idea. But one of the things that the Radium Girls did by fighting in court is that they left so much documentation about the efforts that the radium company and other radium companies undertook to suppress the story, to distort the story, to drag out the case so that the Radium Girls would die before it went to trial. And I think that so many of those tactics and tools of distortion are still employed today, but they might be employed in places where people aren't as clear of a danger or something that is harmful. Mm-hmm. And so I think that having that historic example to look at is can be really effective to understand what's happening today. And that's just one example.
The name of the film is Radium Girls. It was co-directed by Lydia Dean Pilcher and Ginny Moeller, who also co-wrote the screenplay. It'll be playing at Quad Cinema April 3rd through the 9th, followed by a national rollout. Lydia and Ginny, thanks for coming to All of It.
Thank you.
Thank you.